Hello, people of Olympia. This is No Truth on KOWA 106.5. And on this show, we talk about Christianity today and in the past. Today, I want to talk about a story. Not a story, but something that happened to me today. And I also want to talk about the alliance between Christianity and the U.S. government and the many evils perpetuated by that evil empire. I also want to touch on some issues about aid to Haiti and Christian aid organizations, and we're going to talk about different aspects of that. And it's going to be a pretty good show. So, here's a link of arrival. We'll finish this song out and then we'll get going.
All she ever paid attention to in this life, I am that doubt forever by her side. You all will be defeated by the blink of her eye, by the blink of her eye.
That was Blink of Her Eye by me. And I want to talk about that song a little bit. It's the blink of her eye. And she is the great goddess, and who's spoken of in many traditions around the world, who I'm not proselytizing for, but who I can talk about, you know, just to counter the normal patriarchal deities we encounter in Western traditions. That song is Blink of Her Eye, and I talk about the goddess, and I say, you all will be defeated by the blink of her eye, and you all, who are you? Well, I don't know, but I want to tell you what happened to me this morning, because I thought it was a very sacred experience. I thought it was something really magical. I like real things. I like real experiences. I don't need crazy, convoluted, abstract arguments. Today I was riding my bike, and I heard these crows screaming in a way that I'm not used to. I haven't really heard them scream like that. They were all excited, squawking like, ah! And then I heard this whistling noise, like, amongst the caws. And it was like, and I came around the corner, and I saw a little hawk, a small hawk, like, I don't know what they're called, sparrow hawk or something. It was sitting there looking all alarmed, making this screechy whistle noise. And there was a bunch of crows, like 20 or 30 crows all around it, surrounding it. And I just interrupted this strange event. And this hawk was sitting on the ground, and it had something in its leg, and I wanted to see what it was, so I rode my bike a little closer, and all the crows flew up, landed on the power lines, and then just stood there, sat on the power lines and looked at me, made funny little noises. They were obviously curious about me, or they were mad that I was interrupting this exchange. But then this hawk was looking at me all frightened, and it had I saw that it had a starling in its foot. And then I just kind of kept looking at the hawk, and it got tired of being next to me, and there weren't any crows around it messing with it, and it flew away with this starling in its foot. And then in midair, it dropped the starling, probably on accident, probably my fault, and the starling fell for a second and then caught itself away. So it was just laying there dormant while I was looking at it on the hawk's foot, but it was still full of life, and it just flew away. And the crows were on the power line just right above my head looking at me, making funny little noises, not like normal caws, but like call, call, oh, and all sorts of weird noises. But it just struck me as particularly important. It felt like the unconscious, it was like a synchronistic event. It felt like I was supposed to learn something from it. And it's not like it was a religious experience. It wasn't connected to any kind of symbols from any kind of religion. It was just like my experience of these animals, these other beings doing this thing. And I'm a human, and so I put meaning in things, and I put meaning into that. And I immediately came to my mind that starlings are an invasive species. And crows aren't necessarily an invasive species, but they do well living in human civilization. And hawks are indigenous. Now, this hawk was eating a starling, and the starling are invasive. And white people are invasive. It was a confusing situation, but it was impactful. But now I want to talk about Christianity and the U.S. government. Christianity and the U.S. government have, since the first waves of the North American invasion, been holding hands, skipping across the land, stealing it, and exploiting the native people in every way possible. It's not that any individual white person or European is any smarter or stronger than any other individual of any other ethnicity. It's just that white people have formed some very deceptive, aggressive, and evil-intentioned institutions. It's not that Christianity is in any way superior to any other religion. It's just that it's been more aggressive. It's been a more aggressive missionary religion. It has the thickest authoritarianism of any religion. Maybe not, but it's really obsessed with feelings of power and authority. It knows the truth, and it will tell you it has a duty to tell you the truth. But it was also aided in its conquest of North America by its position as the state religion of the United States, which it still holds. If Christianity is to continue proclaiming that it is an authentic religion, providing real answers, relevant answers to real people, it must confront the horrible injustices which it has committed in alliance with the American government. Until then, Christianity will continue to be seen by anyone with critical thinking skills as a tool of the wealthy white male. And if the U.S. government wants to continue to speak of the imaginary separation of church and state, it too must confront the problems which have emerged from the dark alliance between the evil empires. There is, even today, no such thing as separation of church and state. While it would be great if we could achieve such a feat, our political process is totally bogged down by all sorts of Christian morals, which are not necessarily healthy. Remember Bush's faith-based initiatives? He said in 2004 in a speech at New Orleans, "We want to fund programs that save Americans, one soul at a time." That's insane. The U.S. government shouldn't want to save any soul. If Bush was able to push for those faith-based initiatives as President of the United States, there's obviously still very much Christian influence guiding the formation of high-level policy. For proof of the effects of Christianity, and to see how it treats people and to see the outcomes of its easy yoke, or whatever they call it, one needs to only review the history of the church's relationship with Native American nations. It beat the languages and religions out of. President Grant, in 1870, officially handed over reservation affairs to Christian denominations which could prove they were engaged in missionary activity. This had a huge impact on American Christianity's evolution. It amplified those of Christianity which most aggressively engaged in missionary activity. It gave almost unlimited resources to those churches which displayed the strongest desire to destroy native culture. Together, the United States government and Christianity sought to steal the land of the Indian nations, to destroy their languages, and to destroy their freedom of religious expression. They called this civilizing the Indians. It was a Christian activity. With the help of the U.S. government, the Indians were imprisoned on reservations, and their children were forced into Christian prison schools, where the insanity of Christianity was forced onto the young and impressionable children. This is a subtle and effective form of genocide, not simply some abstract form of cultural genocide, but actual genocide. There is no honor for the people of the United States who do not recognize that they are still participating in this atrocity. You may think that all these horrible things I'm talking about happened a long time ago, and horrible things have been happening for a long time, but horrible injustices are being committed today, and your indifference is contributing to the schizophrenia of our nation's relationship with tribal governments. All treaty promises must be restored. The millions of acres of land must be returned. All the money should be given. All the money owed to the tribes must be given. We're living on stolen land. Our nation is a lying nation. It's a big fat liar. We're living on stolen land, even according to our own laws. Neither is there any credibility for any form of Christianity today that does not recognize the evils it has also perpetuated. All Christians must actively seek to repair the wrongs committed by their spiritual ancestors. First, by withdrawing its missionary activities, and then they need to learn to respect other traditions. And for all you non-Christian Euro-Americans out there who think you are free from blame, I say that non-Christians today, many of them, not all of them, are influenced from the inside out by Christian morality. While you don't believe the same lies, you behave in the same schizophrenic ways. Many forms of atheism are simple and uncritical reactions to Christianity. Atheisms define themselves only in opposition to Christian theology. A true atheist must go way further. Someone who has truly shaken off the poisons of the Christian worldview must be involved in a process of constant redefinition of self. It's very hard work, and if you don't think it is, that's because you aren't doing it. We can't just go wash off our ancestral tendencies. We can't just erase the lies of authoritarian orthodoxy from our mind. We must swallow them whole, digest them. We must take them in and understand them. We must confront them and feel accountability. We must be responsible for the actions of our ancestors. Sometimes we might feel guilty. Coping with intergenerational trauma brings up many emotions for all parties involved, but it's not up to Euro-Americans to forgive ourselves. It's up to us to be accountable for our ancestors' insanity. If we will not hold ourselves accountable, how will justice be done? And it's not some abstract emotional forgiveness or some kind of spiritual atonement that white people must engage in, but it's really a concrete legal issue. We made treaties as a nation with nations, and we did not honor them. We are liars. And we have been afflicted with amnesia as a culture. We can't even remember a couple generations ago. We barely even talk to our parents, let alone our grandparents. Maybe this has something to do with it. It makes sense that we can't remember the treaties. We can't remember anything. Mainstream Christian culture can be heard in pop culture, mocking minority groups who have family solidarity. I'm thinking of comedians I've heard on TV that make fun of Mexicans and how extended families live in close proximity, often under one roof. Many of us white Christian people laugh at minority people who must live more communally than we do, but it is easy to see that our mocking is just a show. those of us who are pointing fingers are really just jealous because we have, as a patriarchal Christian culture, created a very unhealthy family structure. Yes, Christian patriarchy has a large role in the destruction of the modern family. Just look at their concept of the Trinity. Few people know that when they say Holy Spirit, they are speaking of a great goddess whose every attribute has been stolen or destroyed, and she's just a blank Holy Spirit. All gender has been sucked out of her. The only place a sign is given is in the roots of the words of the Hebrew and the Greek. In Greek, it's Hagio Pneuma. It's like the sacred breath, the sacred wind, the sacred air. And in Hebrew, it's Ruach HaKodesh. And Greek and Hebrew together, and Aramaic and some other languages, contain many of the ideas which got transferred into Christianity that we have to encounter today. And both of these terms are feminine terms in their respective languages. In the Gospel of Philip, which is a gospel from Nag Hammadi, Egypt, in the Nag Hammadi collection found in the 40s, they're probably buried in the mid-300s, and they contain texts that were probably older than some of the texts in the New Testament. But in the Gospel of Philip, the author mocks those who believe that Mary was impregnated by the Holy Spirit. The author of Philip says something like, "Doesn't everyone know that a female cannot impregnate a female?" So the author of Philip obviously doesn't believe that the Holy Spirit impregnated Mary, because he believes the Holy Spirit is a goddess. The Gospel of Philip is a very early Christian handbook, explaining some early Christian sacraments and their meanings. To see that it speaks of the Holy Spirit as feminine shows us that not all early Christians were insane patriarchal warlords. While elements of patriarchy are present in most all early Christian texts, the degree of woman-hating varies from text to text. Very early on, Christians were worshiping a goddess of some sort. Or some Christians were. And Jesus, according to many early Christians, was only important in relation to that goddess, known as Sophia, embodied in Mary. And Jesus was an embodiment of Logos. And these are ideas contained in some early Christian texts, some from Nag Hammadi, and some of the elements can be found in documents that we had before the Nag Hammadi discovery. And these documents outline this story where there's these divine figures in the place called Pleroma, which is the totality, and Sophia is the very last emanation of the totality, and Logos is in the center. Sophia is wisdom, Logos is knowledge, basically, and they are counterparts. And Sophia is responsible for the creation of the world, and she got imprisoned by her evil son, who became the architect of the universe. But we'll have to talk about all that on another show. All these things I'm saying might be unfamiliar to many modern Christians, but this is because of the brainwashing campaign that Christianity has been on for the last 2,000 years. Just remember this: Christianity is, and has always been, a very diverse movement. There has never been a time when everyone agreed who Jesus was and why he was important. So when someone comes to you today and asks you if you've accepted Jesus and his teachings into your heart, you should remember what I'm telling you here, and you should go look it up yourself and learn about it. I can't convince you, but I know fully, I'm fully confident that Christianity is today and has always been a very diverse movement. No one knows the truth. It's crazy. And it has bred some kind of strange organizations that claim to help people, but only help people based upon these conditions, based upon the whether or not they accept their dogma, their statements of creed. One of those organizations is the Salvation. And the Salvation Army's stated objectives are, and this is from Wikipedia, the advancement of the Christian religion as promulgated in the religious doctrines, which are professed, believed, and taught by the Army, and, pursuant thereto, the advancement of education, the relief of poverty, and other charitable objects beneficial to society, or the community of mankind as a whole. So, its main objective, stated first, bold and clear, is the advancement of the Christian religion as promulgated in the religious doctrines. So their goal is to advance the Christian religion. But what I wonder is, like, which doctrines are they trying to advance? Because Christianity is and has always been a very diverse movement. People who try to present it as a coherent ideological system are certainly trying to deceive me. From the beginning, there have been disagreements about every aspect of what Christians think is important, who Jesus is and why he matters. I would like to know specifically which doctrines lead the Salvation Army. No aid organization of any variety can be effective unless its first goal is to help people. If help comes only after conversion or with the condition of being subjected to indoctrination, it's not help. It's missionary activity. No one needs missionary activity. This is an important topic today due to the recent hardships endured by the Haitian people. We must make sure that when we donate to help them, we are actually doing a good thing, donating to a credible organization, not a Christian organization, or not a Christian organization that will use its aid to further its dogma. We should be careful to not just support further missionary activity in this time of crisis. Now is not the time to proselytize. But I'm here in the studio with my good friend D, and he has more experience with the Salvation Army than I do. And I was wondering if he could share some insights about its nature and what it feels like to receive their easy yoke and red blood fire, whatever they say.
Well, I know that anytime I go into the Salvation Army or nearly any other organization like that in many places in the country, be it, you know, the ones in Seattle or the ones down in Portland or this place called A-Hope down in North Carolina, I always come out in a really, really bad mood and feel like I've just ingested a whole lot of nonsense and a whole lot of confusion. And one day I walked in there and it seemed like every time I would go into the Salvation Army, the ladies who worked behind the counter would make some excuse to say use the letters six and three. They would say, "I need three plates." Well, I need six forks. You know, they would always say the word six and three whenever
That's
I would
strange.
Go in there. And so I think that perhaps if they are trying to, perpetuate and spread the Christian message and make the world more Christian, you know, perpetuate Christianity, then they're probably doing it by keeping the poor people weak and timid and meek. And the reason that they would do that to perpetuate Christianity is because Christianity relies on poverty. The Christian message means nothing unless there is poverty and despair in the world. So the only way that I can see that they are perpetuating Christianity is by keeping people impoverished and in despair, so they will keep praying to Jesus to relieve them from it.
Yeah,
well, sounds like the work of the devil to me.
That's a good point. And I think Christians in general like to see suffering because they have this doctrine of original sin, which states that everyone is sinful. And everyone must seek to be forgiven because they are inherently bad people. So it's good for them to get a bunch of people together who they can like feel pity for and like be like, oh, yeah, these poor people, I'm doing such a great thing by spreading my insanity into their brains.
So then they'll get a big white house up in heaven with a bunch of with some cars in the garage and a TV, and they can be the cool ones on the block in heaven.
Yeah.
Well, that's what they used to tell us at the Baptist church. They said the more people you save, the more treasures you're gonna have in heaven.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, heaven's a big concept, and I think 80% of Americans, according to, I think, I'm not going to say where I heard that because I'm not exactly sure, but 80% of Americans believe in heaven. I think that's the main power of Christianity today, is people's fear of death.
And fear of each other themselves, and every time I walk out of the Salvation Army, I feel afraid and angry and confused and not comfortable in my own skin. And so what would be a person's next action after that? They would feel all those things and then bow down to some god to relieve them from it, you know? And yeah, so I guess they're doing a good job.
Well,
if that's their plan.
How's their food and how's
their food is horrible.
Is it freely accessible, or is it a welcoming vibe? Do they want you to come partake of their bounty?
No.
What is the attitude? What is it like?
They look at you like you're a prisoner. They look at you like you are a prisoner. It's like an institution, and they don't think of you as a second class citizen. They think of you as an animal who is to be kept like away, and they think that they're doing some great, like insanely humanitarian, graceful thing by even looking at you. You know? And the food there is usually some kind of noodly goulash with probably the most disgusting pork in the world in it, you know, and like applesauce and some Kool-Aid, you know. Yep. I would suggest anyone out there who, a lot of people, when they're sitting around and they see the homeless people and they walk by the street and see the homeless people, they think like, oh, well, why don't they just go to Salvation Army? And I'm telling you right now, if that's your little scapegoat in your head that you use to not feel bad about not doing anything to help the homeless, that's not a good one, you know?
Yeah,
And so just cut that feeling right out and go to your house and make some peanut butter sandwiches and ride around with them, or donate some food to Eddie Hop or something. Eddie Hop actually is pretty good, but they don't have the funding that the Salvation Army has, because
yeah,
the Salvation Army is government funded.
Yeah,
and they're a Christian organization.
Back to the government Christianity Alliance and its evil empire. It's pretty crazy.
And not only that, but the Salvation Army was also started by a person who was in like a retired colonel or something like that.
Yeah.
And they run it like an army. I used to have to do community service at a Salvation Army thrift store, and the boss is like the captain, and his boss is the sergeant and the general and on up. It's the most ridiculous thing ever.
Yeah.
And how does an army have anything to do with Jesus?
Yeah,
who said he was a nonviolent person?
He was completely nonviolent, and there's no argument that is of any worth that says that he was a violent person. So it's pretty crazy. But since I've been talking about the crazy alliance and Christianity and the government, its ill effects on the Native American people, I want to play this Russell Means talking about this recent move by the Lakota Nation to withdraw treaties it made, I think, 150 years ago, and now it's going to be its own country. The Indian nations are already sovereign entities, but this is a step further, and I think we deserve to give an ear to Russell Means as Euro-American people. And I think it's a good top off for this show. So here it is.
What do you think tribal sovereignty means in the 21st century, and how do we resolve conflicts between tribes and the federal and state governments?
Yeah. Tribal sovereignty means that it's sovereign. I mean, you've been given sovereignty, and you're viewed as a sovereign entity.
Okay.
And therefore, the relationship between the federal government and tribes is one between sovereign entities.
I just love that soundbite so much, y'all. The one guy who's in the audience, you can hear him start clapping. He thinks it's so funny. Anyway, so this is Anti-War Radio. Welcome back to the show. Our first guest today is Russell Means. He's the chief facilitator of the newly declared independent Republic of Lakota. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, it's an honor to talk with you. Of course, I talked with Eric Garris, the founder of Antiwar.com, and told him I was going to be interviewing you, and he immediately started with all kinds of stories of you and Justin, and Justin Raimondo and him and the Libertarian Party back in the 1980s, and it's pretty interesting stuff. Small world, I guess.
Yes, it is.
All right, well, so I didn't even realize, sir, this story had gotten away from me. It turns out it's been almost a year since you and I'm not exactly sure who all else went to Washington, D.C. to the State Department over there to Condoleezza Rice's office and I guess delivered her papers declaring independence on behalf of the Republic of Lakota. Is that basically right?
Well... with a small correction, an important one, is we withdrew from our treaties with the United States. We unilaterally withdrew according to the protocol of the Law of Treaties, the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, which is all nations are signatories to that law. So we are, and what happens with that withdrawal from our treaties is that we revert back to the legal status we had prior to the signing of the treaties, which means we're free and independent. So our territory, as you can see from our website, goes into five states, western South Dakota and parts of North Dakota, Montana, Wyoming, and about 70% of Nebraska.
Right, and in not too much, a little bit, I guess, of research I was able to do on this, I saw that you really emphasized the point that you're not seceding because
we were never part of the United States because of the treaties. And that's why on federal Indian law throughout the United States, I mean federal Indian land, it's called, because they hold the land in trust, and therefore we cannot utilize the land for economic purposes unless we... we want to farm, and then it's impossible because we can't get credit because the United States of America holds the land in trust. Nevertheless, we do have a sovereign status, which means the United States of America's Constitution does not apply to us on the Indian reservations of America. Consequently, we have no protections against government or police or politicians or individual entrepreneurs or anyone that wants to bilk us and our resources. So we end up in a welfare state if we stay on the land. Mm-hmm. So consequently, what has resulted in this colonial barbarity is a diaspora of 75% of our people who have been forced just out of, to make a living, just have a home, been forced off the reservations to in order to exist. So we have a diaspora throughout America.
Well, so George Bush really is not even anywhere close when he said in that quote that the relationship is one between two sovereigns. That's how you're trying to make it now, but it's been basically a relationship between an occupier and occupiee this whole time.
That's right. The classic colonial third world setup. And so in order to eventually take all of our land, the only economic enterprise allowed are casinos, which further enhance and ingratiate the colonial governmental setups, which causes it to be a third world situation. At the whim of Congress, we are at the whim of Congress and the executive. And the Supreme Court offers no protections because we don't have any rights. So the policies of federal government, which are not laws passed by Congress, and the laws of Congress are what rule us. Consequently, we don't have a prayer, and we're bilked to the nth degree. One only has to go to an Indian reservation, and you can see that the surrounding areas are benefiting from the so-called welfare we receive. We don't receive checks in the mail. What we receive is welfare that goes immediately to the surrounding areas, the white businesses and the white cities and towns that border on the reservation. Consequently, like you take South Dakota, for instance, which has 9 Sioux Indian reservations in the state, we are less than 10% of the total state population, but we're 25% of South Dakota's tax base. And we don't pay property taxes because our land is held in trust.
So that's all the federal government money that comes and kind of bounces off the reservation and lands in the pockets.
You nailed it.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I think it's, you can't get credit. The Indians can't get credit because the land is held in trust by the U.S., so you don't have any collateral to put up.
That's exactly right.
What a scam. I have
to
tell you, Russell, I guess I've known my whole life that, and I think that, you know, my view probably approximates that of, you know, the average white person in America. I've known my whole life that Indians are always very poor on their reservations, but not really why. But you just nailed it because you don't have any property rights.
Correct. So that's why, you know, the uninitiated and the racist persons in America, they say, well, why don't the Indians just pull themselves up by their own bootstraps? They've got land. Yeah, right.
Wow. So, well, and I think also, you know, people who are advocates of property rights seldom are the leaders of civil rights movements. And so if you have anybody sticking up, any whites sticking up for the rights of Indians, they're more likely liberal leftists who don't understand property rights at all and aren't going to be much help in that situation.
Actually, the liberal leftists are the worst thing that's ever happened to America, let alone Indian people, but they are extremely racist against Indian people. The liberal left is our worst enemy. It's been the Democrats in Congress that have consistently, for over almost two centuries, that have put the most debilitating laws into effect that strip us bit by bit of our freedoms.
Well, let me try to play the devil's advocate here a little bit. I think I got one. If the Indians on the reservations got title to their land and had real property rights to it, they could turn around and sell it all off to the whites, and then there'd be nothing left. So maybe this is at least done with a view toward protecting the Indian lands from being all sold off to the highest bidder.
That's exactly the excuse they gave to the world, and they still do today. However, I want to give you a very huge example of how wrong that is. They stole the Black Hills from us, the Black Hills of South Dakota that go into Wyoming. They stole that from us, and then they tried to, I'm making a very long story short, very short. Then they tried to say that, well, we didn't have any rights to claiming it back, even though our treaty, which is supported by the Article 6 of the United States Constitution, they just ignored that treaty, and they said, well, you know, it's too late now, so we'll buy it from you. But at 1870 land prices, at $17 an acre, there's over about 90,000 acres of land. So they calculated the money. It came out to... it was less than $17 an hour, I'm sorry, because it came out to $17 million they were going to pay us for the Black Hills of South Dakota, because they said we didn't know anything about its riches. And then they said, well, it's been all these years, so there's interest. So they awarded us in 1979 $105 million. Well, if the case was that if we didn't have the land, we would sell it, we have refused, even though we are the poorest people in the United States of America. And the Pine Ridge Sioux Indian Reservation, the second largest reservation, is the poorest not only in America but in the world. Even though with those statistics, we continue to continually refuse the money. And the interest-bearing account that it was in the Department of Treasury up to a few years ago, it got to about $1.2 billion. And then Congress says, oh, wait a minute, these guys aren't accepting the money, and this is really starting to add up hugely because it's now $1 billion. And my God, you know, 5% per annum is really going to make that grow. So they took it out of the interest-bearing account, and that money's laying in limbo somewhere, not drawing anything. But we still refuse it, even though our median income is between $3,500 to $4,000 per family. And as you may or may not know, the level of, if you earn below $14,000 in America, you're considered poverty. And we have less than 20% of that.
Jeez. All right, well, so let's talk a little bit about what you're trying to do about this. I'm interested in this movement for renewed independence. Basically, your claim is that the treaty's already broken, the U.S. broke it, and all you're doing is officially withdrawing from it, right?
That's correct.
And now, what exactly is your position within the Lakota Nation, and how does it relate to all the various tribal councils and all those politics? I mean, I really have no idea how all that stuff works.
Well, if you want to look at Colombia or Guatemala or any other regime around the world that America has colonized economically, you will find the same thing on the reservation. In fact, that colonial technique was bred and born on Indian reservations in the United States. And in fact, it even goes to you American people who you can't see it because of the educational veil they put over your eyes and dumbed down your brain, is that every major policy they've employed in colonizing the world, they now have put upon the backs of the American people. You don't even know it, but you're the new Indians of the 21st century, and that's very, very sad. But what we're doing in the Republic of Lakota...
Well, wait a minute. Let me stop you right there, because I'm sorry, because I did ask you the question, but that's very interesting. You're saying the model that the U.S. government used to colonize the Indians and has used in waging its empire around the world is the same model that is now being instituted onto the American people in front of their very eyes, whether they realize it or not.
That's correct.
And how exactly do you define that model?
Well, it's very easy for you American people. Look at your health policies and your and those corporations. That form of health policy that you're now suffering under was bred and born on a reservation. Your land policies, which the corporations have taken out and eased off the family farmer and family rancher, because guess what? They're in the way of progress. That's what they said about Indian people. So now you have corporate farming controlling the land. That policy is bred and born on Indian reservations. The continual land grabbing was bred and born on reservations. Your education system, bred and born on reservations. The dumbing down of America, not allowing you to know your own history, not allowing you anything except specialized vocations, so that your focus will be absolutely narrowed to your meager existence in life. And then finally, turning your entire country from a producing productive monolith in an economic giant in the late 50s and beginning in a 25-year period. By the mid-80s, the United States of America had switched from being a productive producing country to being a consumer country with even more limitations on your world view, if you have one. So all of these policies are the colonization of the American people. And now if you want to look on the world stage, Hitler, Adolf Hitler, the Nazi, wrote in the 1920s, this is before he became Chancellor of Germany, wrote in his book that the United States of America has the right idea on separating unwashed, unwanted races from the master race. And that is, pen them up. And that gave birth, the Indian reservation system gave birth to what he called labor camps, in which we now know as concentration camps. The Bantu Development Act passed in 1964 in South Africa, which institutionalized apartheid, was bred and born from the Indian Reorganization Act of America passed 30 years prior in 1934. So apartheid and Nazism, those two regimes are dead and gone, but the role model continues to exist. And this is what you have in the West Bank of Palestine, is the land grab and the stealing of the natural resources of the Palestinian people. Now, Iraq is the latest Indian reservation. You've got Afghanistan as an Indian reservation, and you're hoping to advance through Pakistan. And under Obama, you probably will. But
well, you know, it's interesting. I'm sure you've seen
called the United States of America. It was all bred and born on Indian reservations.
Well, you know, I'm sure you've seen the news stories where American soldiers at fire bases camped out in the middle of nowhere in Afghanistan refer to Central Asia as engine country.
Exactly. That's Iraq also. You know, they say when they go on patrol, well, we're going out to engine country.
As though, you know, all of Asia is the Wild West to be conquered and manifest destinied and genocided, apparently.
That's exactly right.
It really is incredible. And, you know, when you bring up the Nazis there, it's sort of unfortunate. They were so evil that to invoke them at all sort of, I mean, it always just ends up sounding like hyperbole. Except it's true, though, that Hitler cited Andrew Jackson and the forced march to Oklahoma of the Cherokee, that they copied their eugenics programs, which, of course, were used against American Indians in this country. John Gatto has written about how when the Nazis would tie a woman down and cut her ovaries out against her will, they called that the Indiana procedure, because
right.
That's where it was pioneered.
That's exactly right.
All right. Well, okay. Now, so to my question again, the politics of the Lakota Nation. I'm very interested in, you know, I think some people in the media might portray this as nothing more than the Montana Freeman pretending that they're declaring independence, or McLaren and the Republican Texas guys who tried to secede from the Union a few years back and not give this much credence. How legitimate is your position among
on our website, republicoflakota.com, we quote Gandhi, in which he said, first they ignore you, then they make fun of you, then they fight you, then you win. Now, what we're doing is completely non-threatening, and it's completely legal and lawful, backed by the Constitution of the United States and international law. But we're happy to be ignored. We're happy to be considered kooks and irrelevant. That's fine, because right now, and we have been involved for the last 12 months in re-solidifying the foundations of our freedom. And we have volunteers, non-Indian volunteers, who have emigrated to the Republic of Lakota, working with us as Lakota now, because they have become citizens And these are both black and white and Chicano people that have come to the Republic of Lakota seeking freedom. We, like on our website, we encourage and we allow these people in, to come into our country as long as they're self-sufficient and that they understand that being free is not free. And that freedom means you are free to be responsible. And if you're a responsible person, of course, you don't make a paper entity into your economic equal or, in fact, superior like they have with corporations in America. And to allow that to happen is irresponsible. So you see, you have America that is full of irresponsible people who have allowed themselves to be enslaved. Now, the Republic of Lakota, we have a provisional government, of which I am chief facilitator. And we have other facilitators and directors and what have you that are, like I say, we're rebuilding the foundation. And once that foundation is, now, absolutely, we have absolutely no anything to do with the colonial system of America put in place called tribal governments. That means, of course, the only proof we have that we represent the people. I ran for tribal president on the Pine Ridge Sioux Indian Reservation this past November, and even though it was, some say, a crooked election, I got 45% of the vote. So insofar as the largest Sioux Indian reservation with the most people in our entire country, we're going to do this on every reservation. We're going to run a candidate for president based on freedom and that number and that vote. So this is going to take 2 to 3 years to complete that strategy, that political strategy, and then we can present it to the world as bona fide of the people we represent. We're also going to be hiring. We're instituting our economic packages and our educational packages, our political packages, and that's the strategies, our health also. We have four areas that we are instituting because the people are not going to gravitate to you unless you can produce some tangible results of freedom. And this is exactly what we're doing. And where we are living in the area of North and South Dakota, which is the Republic of Lakota, that has been termed the Saudi Arabia of wind energy. And yet, and then that wind, and this is what the experts say, there's enough wind in the western part of North and South Dakota that can produce all the electricity the United States of America needs 24/7.
What?
That's true. That's what the experts state.
Of the whole country?
Of the whole country. Enough wind power just in western North and South Dakota.
Wow, it must be cold as all get out up there.
Well, in the wintertime it does get cold, and that's fine.
It actually snowed a little bit last night here in Austin, Texas. I couldn't believe it. Sorry, I still have that on the brain here in the middle of this interview. Sorry.
Global warmth. But the point is, we have the energy. Now, do you think that coal companies, which are subsidiaries to the oil companies, do you think that they're developing that? Hell no. They're allowing a few wind farms. Look what we're doing, you know, just like British Petroleum and their ads on TV.
Right.
This is what we're doing, you know?
Uh-huh.
So that's all you'll get is piecemeal wind farms for show places.
Well, and that kind of brings me to the other question. If you can, which you did answer what I was really getting at there well, which is your strategy to really build consensus and win elections throughout the reservation system to prove your legitimacy. And that kind of thing. But when you bring up the competition between oil and coal companies and a newly independent Lakota nation, are you not seriously facing the question of invasion by the U.S. government to put down any such thing if this was
to
really be successful?
We're not going to go after the blatant competition with the coal companies by producing wind farms. We know that because the coal companies and the oil companies, the energy companies, essentially, own the grids. So even if we did put up wind farms, we'd still have to give the energy over to the grids, which and which the coal companies own, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we want to do it house by house, and to solidify our nation. And that technology is practically very inexpensive. It's almost free.
Well, and it sounds like you could really make Lakota Nation very wealthy with that kind of
yes,
energy.
And you know, I learned in the ninth grade back when the United States of America was still a producing, productive country. Back in the 50s, when I went in the ninth grade, I took economics, and the basic law I learned in that class was that those that control the energy control the economics. So look at America if you want proof. So consequently, that's what we want to do, is each individual controls their own energy. We have not only that, but on the northern plains, we have the sun shines on us over 300 days of the year.
So
that's enormous power. We also have under our reservation and under the Black Hills geothermal water that has been totally ignored and not developed whatsoever.
Well, and what about this? It looks to me like on the map you also have Omaha. And
right.
Now we really get to the rub. Are the people of Omaha going to want to join? Is the U.S. government ever going to recognize what they would see, at least, as a secessionist power running off with a giant city like that?
Well, wait a minute. You know, our strategy is piecemeal and individual. So if we want to promote individual liberty, you have to have individual economics.
That was Russell Means talking about the Republic of Lakota, which on this show where we explore the effects of Christianity on the world is completely relevant due to the alliance of Christianity and the U.S. government and their conquest of North America. Thank you, Russell, for being very awesome and telling the truth. And you're listening to, or this was, you're listening to KOWA 106.5. And if you would like to contribute in any way, you can come down here to 816 Adams Street, across from the Timberland Library, or you can... We'd really appreciate some donations. And coming up next is Democracy Now! And I'm Book Dog, Prophet of Thunder. This was No Truth. Thank you very much.
At KOWA 106.5, okay? So I just know that you're a terrorist. And what?
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! We're broadcasting from the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah. Filmmaker Michael Moore on the Democrats, Haiti, Hope, and his role in the Supreme Court decision that opened the floodgates to corporate money in politics. And in a national broadcast exclusive, we speak with prominent Haitian New Yorker and community activist Jean Montreville. He's just been released from jail in New York after being held for 3 weeks by immigration authorities.